We're still 5 days from Labor Day, and it's been a very big and destructive fire season already. This season sharpened the debate over the proper management of forests and proved once again that we can talk until we're blue in the face about how the forests functioned naturally, but they don't anymore, at least in the sense that they do not function in the absence of people. People live here in great numbers, and people affect forests, and obviously vice versa. Our first guest on today's exchange looks deeply into connections between people and land use, forests included. Jeffrey Klein is a research forester with the USDA Forest Service. He's based at the Pacific Northwest Research Station in Corvallis. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What is the general nature of your research?
Well, I'm an economist by training, an environmental economist, and I came to Oregon 21 years ago with an interest in land use. I grew up on the East Coast and saw much of the in the Philadelphia area and saw much of the landscape I grew up in become developed, and so I came here with a set of interests. So much of my research since then has been involving anticipating the pace and pattern of development, especially around forests, and evaluating policies with which to influence development and land conservation, and understanding how forest landowners manage their forest lands in the face of development, and finally, understanding how more urban homeowners located near forest lands interact with forests, and more these days in the Forest Service that involves working in the context of wildfire and how they react to wildfire.
I wonder if Oregon appealed to you specifically because of the statewide land use planning guidelines.
No, actually, it was because my partner had a job here. But yeah, it's turned out the land use law actually has ended up being quite a laboratory for me, and I've done a lot of work with that.
All right, I do want to get to that later on. I want to get to some of the general stuff before we even get to Oregon's land use peculiarities first. I'm struck by a sentence on your page at the Forest Service about why the research is important, that development of forest and other open space land is inevitable. Now, and I want to be careful about the wording, because that doesn't mean the development of all of it is inevitable, does it?
No, but I guess the reason that I always make that statement is that as long as we have a growing population in this country, we're going to need to house people somewhere. We also have a fairly strong system of private property rights, which limits the extent to which we can regulate land use. So, for example, in Oregon, we regulate land use with the land use law, but you can't stop all development. It's just given our system of private property rights. And so that statement is just to kind of acknowledge that this process is going to continue as long as we have population growth.
There's something of a disconnect, isn't there? I mean, for the fact that there are some people who will move out to wide open spaces because they like it there. They'll build a house in the country and not realize that by building a house in the country, they are taking up some of the open space that they enjoyed so much when they visited.
Yeah, that's the conundrum. There's in land use, we used to talk about kind of loving the land to death, where, people move out for natural amenities or because of the wide open spaces. They like the wide open spaces. But they end up, creating a place that they no longer enjoy.
So there's great pressure then, it would seem, on forest and other open space land that remains open.
That's right. And I think one of the funny things, if I talk about my own experience a little bit, coming from the East Coast, the area I grew up west of Philadelphia was very rural and pastoral when I was a kid. And then nowadays, the last farms are being made into golf courses and soccer fields. And I think when I moved to the West Coast, I had the sense that they were much more in an earlier stage of that process. And there's a lot of land out here still. But certainly when you look at places like the Willamette Valley, with the growing cities and such, eventually those places are going to change. To me, when I first moved here, the Willamette Valley looked like New Jersey 50, 60 years ago. New Jersey was very agricultural, but eventually population increased to the point where, the urban areas expanded within them and stuff. And so that's not to say that Oregon's going to turn into New Jersey. I think far from it. And we have a lot of public lands and things that have protected a lot of open space. But certainly, these forces are coming as long as the population continues to grow.
I don't want to shock anybody. Yeah, we're not going to turn into New Jersey.
I mean, yeah.
Let's be clear.
Not at all.
All right. But one of the constraints here, I mean, again, aside from any laws that come down to the state and local level in Oregon, the fact is that so much of the land is owned in Oregon by the federal government. There are limits to how far cities can extend outward.
That's right. That's right. And you know, when you, like, since I'm kind of centric to the Willamette Valley, I always think of that. And, you know, you look up, we're kind of surrounded by the mountains here, the Coast Range on the one side and the Cascades on the other, and a good portion of that is public land. And so, yeah, there is a limited amount of land, private land to build on, although the amount of private land still is significant out here. So there's you guys have a lot of space out here.
People and landscape is the discussion topic here on The Exchange. Jeffrey Klein is a research forester, an environmental economist with the USDA Forest Service based at the Pacific Northwest Research Station in Corvallis. Questions from you, comments about the fact that we have more people and as time goes on, they want to move out into the country. Join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have been talking quite a bit more, it seems like, in recent years, particularly as we have longer and more damaging and smokier fire seasons, about the wildland-urban interface. Are many more people, Jeffrey, living on the edges of the forest or actually somewhat in it?
Well, that's kind of the sense we have. You know, just the wildland-urban interface is that area where structures and other human development meet and intermingle with undeveloped wildland. And in the fire context, it's generally assumed that there's a degree of fire risk because of a historic fire-prone forest. And certainly in Oregon, for example, you can look at examples like Bend or Sun River, and those places are a lot bigger than they used to be, and they're expanding out closer to those fire-prone forests. And so that's the general sense, and I think that's kind of going on all around the country. It's just more in the West where we really see the problem butting up against the fire-prone forest and having that fire wildland-urban interface dynamic going on.
So, do people assume there are going to be certain trade-offs, do you find, when they move out to the edge of the forest? Like, you know, there could be a fire right up to my property or things like, I will be doing things right next to a forest that don't occur naturally in forests, like swimming pools, lawnmowers, barbecues, you name it.
Right. So some of the activities you list there, I'm not sure if people think about that, but in the context of fire, our research over the last couple of years is suggesting that a lot of people are making a conscious decision. So sometimes there's this perception that people are moving to these fire-prone forests and they don't really know what they're getting themselves into and they don't really understand the risks. But our research is suggesting that actually a lot of people, you kind of have two types of people. You have people that grew up in a fire-prone area, you know, people who grew up in Central Oregon, and are still choosing to live there, and they pretty much know that they're living in an area where there's a lot of fire, even with the increases in fire today. You also have people moving into areas from elsewhere, but in general, our research is suggesting that people are sort of making a conscious choice that they want the benefits of the natural amenities that they're getting from living in a wildland-urban interface and are willing to take the risk to do that, and with the understanding that there could be consequences with regard to wildfire.
Does this get us into the realm of what's been referred to as ecosystem services, like they're getting shade from the trees and you know, oxygen and that sort of stuff?
Right. I mean, I'm not sure if they think of in those terms. I think they think more of in terms of scenic views and,
sure,
you know, seeing wildlife and being close to places for outdoor recreation. I mean, that's sort of the folks, when we talk about kind of in-migration or amenity migration in places like Oregon, we're usually thinking about those types of amenities, and I suppose some people think about some of those kind of more less visible sorts of things like clean air and clean water. But I think a lot of times they're just thinking of the amenities that affect them day to day, which would be things like recreation and scenic views and places like that.
So let's turn from residential living to managing the forest to reduce fire danger. I was looking at something you had written about 14 years ago where you really hit the nail on the head, where wildfire is a vexing issue and there's a lot of discussion on fuel reduction. 14 years later, do you think we've reached a point where we can have a discussion about exactly what form that fuel reduction should take?
Oh, goodness. You know, I don't want to sound pessimistic, but I'm not sure we've advanced in our thinking that much. It's a problem. You have a couple different forces that I think are leading to the increased fire risk we face these days. For a long time we've talked about the build up of fuels because of our traditional policies of, you know, swift suppression, and certainly that's a problem. More recently, in the last 10 or 15 years, we've begun to recognize that the climate is changing, leading to hotter, drier conditions in a lot of these forests. And so that's exasperating things. The real problem is trying to, if we were to try to use greater use of prescribed fire or try to use greater use of thinning and harvesting and things like that, those sound good on paper. The difficulty is finding the funding to do that. And within the Forest Service, so much of our budget kind of is reactive and going toward fire suppression that sometimes we really don't have enough funds to do things like thinning or prescribed burning. And in the case of prescribed burning, you also have the additional constraint of smoke. Communities a lot of times don't like the smoke from prescribed burning. And then there are also air quality regulations that prescribed burning even have to comply with. And so that sometimes acts as a constraint on prescribed burning. And so you kind of have an issue of sometimes as an economist, I wonder, will we ever have the funding sufficient to take care of the problem? And I think that's the big question. Will we as a society commit to paying for the work that needs to be done? And I think that's an open question.
Given that that Congress appears to be moving, at least with the big two-year funding bill that was passed a while ago, that they at least will stop borrowing from the other operational budgets to pay for firefighting and the Forest Service budget, do you think that's going to be a big boost to the efforts?
That's definitely a step in the right direction. I mean, the fire borrowing, within the Forest Service, it's always a big headache about this time of year because every aspect of the Forest Service gets affected by that, whether it's, the fire research, field work for conducting fire research so that we have knowledge in the future to address these issues, or whether it's, conducting forest management and doing sorts of different practices. Come midsummer or now, we just got the email a couple weeks ago. Basically, we stop all expenditures because all the leftover money for the fiscal year goes to the fires, and so certainly separating those out should free up funds so that we can continue doing the forest management that we need to do, and continue to conduct the research that we need to do to help over the long term address the fire issue.
So here again, we're talking to Jeffrey Klein, a research forester with the Forest Service based at the Pacific Northwest Research Station in Corvallis. You're welcome to join the conversation by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I'm glad you're an economist because I've been wondering a lot about the economics, not from the Forest Service end of it, but from the end of people who might take part in thinning projects. The more I talk to people about this, it seems like it's not really necessarily a job for a logging company. Anybody who wants to run lumber through mills or run timber through mills to make lumber isn't necessarily interested in a thinning project if it doesn't involve taking out some big enough trees to make it worth their while financially. So then are we talking about a whole different range of companies, the restoration type companies and not timber companies that are more likely to do the thinning work?
Yeah, this is an area I don't work in that often. My sense, though, is you're kind of correct in that, there's always a struggle to find ways to market small diameter wood. I mean, I remember a couple years ago, my local lumber store was trying to sell chunks of juniper trees, that they were trying to sell as kind of landscape ties, and they weren't, they didn't look all that great, and they didn't cost all that much either. But there's always a struggle to find ways to make revenue off of conducting thinning operations using small diameter trees, and so that's always going to pay attention. You always have some political forces that don't want any kind of harvest, and so that's always going to be create some constraints on how much we can do harvest larger trees to kind of subsidize the harvesting of smaller diameter wood that would be more in line with like a thinning for a fuel reduction.
You have done some research with private landowners, I think, haven't you? So, I mean, as well as public. So that, I mean, is there anything going on out there that looks promising in terms of thinning projects that might have some economic benefits?
Nothing that I know of, but I want to qualify that it's not an area, the harvesting part of it and how they market the timber isn't an area that I work with a lot, but I haven't heard of anything. There's no kind of silver bullet out there that I've heard of.
All right. So let me come back to the Oregon land use plan, because we did talk about the fact that this is a state that's not only got the issues that some other Western states have, but it's also got the stuff that came with Senate Bill 100 in the mid-70s about the fact that you have to have urban growth boundaries and places to expand your city, all that sort of thing. So does it do as intended? I mean, is it slowing the development of open space, which is one of the major thrusts of your research?
So, yeah. Over the years since I arrived in Oregon, I've taken a look at Oregon land use planning a couple different times, and the best, and as have a few other researchers here in Oregon too, and the best we can tell is that there is a measurable impact of Oregon land use planning on constraining the amount of development. In other words, when they draw an urban growth boundary, they're doing a fairly decent job at maintaining development within that urban growth boundary. So what land they commit to forest or farm use outside that urban growth boundary, since the plan was adopted, has had a less likelihood of development. Now the thing to recognize, though, is that that municipalities kind of draw their own urban growth boundaries. So how well that works kind of depends on how conservative or how relaxed a community is in drawing that urban growth boundary. So if they draw an urban growth boundary that's not very restrictive, then more land gets developed because the urban growth boundary has been drawn bigger, and vice versa. If a community draws an urban growth boundary more restrictively, less land gets developed. The other factor also is how often they expand that urban growth boundary, and so there is some variability across communities in how restrictive they've used the urban growth boundary process to protect land from development.
And Jeffrey Klein, have you studied the resulting impact that there might be on things like the rate at which homes are built or that any pressures on real estate prices?
Others have. I haven't. A fellow at the Oregon State University had a study, and I think the results are kind of mixed on that. Because you kind of have two processes. On the one hand, you're constraining land for development, which would cause prices to go up. But on the other hand, if the Oregon land use plan is enhancing natural amenities because it's not allowing for sprawl development, that itself can also raise house prices. So
just scarcity, but also nicety.
Right. That's. Yeah.
Okay. We have a question here from Becca in rural Lane County. She wants to know about the definition of urban wildland interface and whether that would include, for example, the small semi-rural communities like Walton between the coast and Eugene.
Oh, Walton. I think it's anywhere where people are, living within the forest and interacting with the forest. I think there's kind of this formal definition that we use in maps, national level maps, that the Forest Service uses to identify places at risk. But I think you have a set of characteristics that occur at different scales like that. And so certainly some of the factors that are involved in the interactions between people and houses and forests occur at smaller scales like that. So yeah, I think those places are relevant to think about.
So basically any place where there's people living in neighborhoods right up to the edge of the forest.
Yeah, that's how I tend to think about it.
I noticed also you've done a fair amount of work on climate change and carbon. You were the lead author on a paper a couple of years ago about evaluating forests for carbon storage and other production possibilities. Did you emerge confident that we can get multiple values out of forests, including carbon storage?
Yeah, I think, that paper, so basically that paper looked at, what were the different types of management activities we could do on forests to store more carbon, to grow more timber, and also have different levels of wildlife habitat. And basically, did we really know the full set of possibilities that we had in producing those things that we want on forests? And, I think what that points to is that we sometimes don't know what's possible, mostly because we focus on what we know and how we've done things in the past, and sometimes we have to kind of think about other possibilities and kind of experiment a little bit, and that's what that paper was trying to point out. Sometimes we don't really know, like if in the when I first arrived in Oregon, it was at the end of the tail end of the spotted owl issue, and I kept as a fresh grad student, I kept wondering, well, is there a way? Has anybody really thought about can we have still have harvesting and still have owls? Are there different management regimes we could use to still do that? And that paper was an attempt to kind of start to look at that those sorts of things. And I think the conclusion is that we need to broaden our thinking and do some experiments to see what we can have. And sometimes that'll depend on trying different types of management regimes that we haven't thought of maybe yet.
Is that a hard one to get across, though, I wonder, because things have been done the same way for decade upon decade, both in industry and on the government side as well?
Yeah, it is. People kind of get entrenched in their positions, and I think the point of that paper is to try to get people thinking a little bit more broadly and not be so entrenched in their positions. And again, we don't have a quick answer there. We don't have a quick answer with that paper, but it showed that there are different ways to get what we want, and not all the times are we doing those things. I should preface too, if anybody ended up trying to find that paper, that we don't look at the costs associated with the different management practices that we're testing there. So we're just saying, what if we do one management practice or another, but we're not paying attention to how much they might cost. We're just looking at ecologically what's possible on a landscape in terms of carbon sequestration, harvest, and different types of habitat.
Just a couple seconds left to ask if you've done any work on pricing of carbon in forests, whether we've figured out their value as storage well enough.
Well, there has been a lot of work on that. I haven't done a lot of that. There has been a lot of work, and you can find, if anybody's that's interested, I'd suggest that they Google social cost of carbon, and that's where you'll find work on that. And we also have, there's some places where there's active carbon markets where, prices are determined actually in the market itself. And so there's a lot of work with that, mm-hmm. that people can find.
All kinds of fascinating stuff going on at the U.S. Northwest, Pacific Northwest Research Station in Corvallis, where Jeffrey Klein is working as a research forester for the Department of Agriculture Forest Service. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. Take care.